Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have a open conference on rules hearings this morning, and before I begin, I want to introduce to you all, and I think that the court has met him, David Schenker, who will be the new clerk of the Supreme Court, and we're delighted with his coming here. He has been with the Indiana Supreme Court, and as a member of the Indiana Bar, I was unhappy that he left Indiana, but absolutely delighted that he came to Wisconsin. So thank you very much, and he has a very impressive resume and writes fiction on the side, but he understands that we do not. Thank you very much. Thank you for appearing today. And you all know Chris Polson, who's the deputy clerk. I'll call the first matter, which is 0606, in the matter of the petition of the State Bar of Wisconsin to amend Chapter 20 of the Supreme Court rules. Is this the shorthand for multi-jurisdictional? Okay. The presenter is a person well known to the court, Dean Diedrich, and he represents the State Bar of Wisconsin Professional Ethics. Mr. Diedrich, let me again say thank you to you, Mr. Diedrich, on behalf of the entire court for your work and your fidelity following through a long process on the Code of Professional Conduct. And here you are. Yet again, the court wants to know, do you ever practice law? How do you make a living? You don't have to answer that. They're rhetorical, but which...
I would probably want to plead the fifth.
Right. Okay. And your partners do, too. Very much practices law, Chief. Good. Well, thank you. And I have as another appearance Stephen Levine. If there's anyone else who is going to appear on that, if you would... give the marshal your names. You can handle that. Mr. Dietrich.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and members of the court. Good morning to you. I have struggled with how I should proceed this morning. I have tried to provide you with a series of documents that describe the history of the working group on multi-jurisdictional practice. Let me touch perhaps on a couple of things very briefly, and then perhaps if it's okay with the court, I would address some of the other submittals to the court as a way of providing information to you. The working group that studied the issue of multi-jurisdictional practice was appointed by the Board of Governors of the State Bar right around 2002. As the court recalls, when the Ethics 2000 Committee was appointed, the issue of multi-jurisdictional practices was excluded from the study of that committee. The working group for which I served as chair specifically studied the issue of multi-jurisdictional practice and potential amendments to Rule 20:5.5, 20:8.5, Pro Hoc Vice, and other ancillary issues. The whole notion of multi-jurisdictional practice and the need to address, shall we say, practices beyond state borders is something that had been about the legal profession and discussed and debated at many different levels. There was a special ABA commission studying multi-jurisdictional practices. Model Rule 5.5 was amended and was included as part of the Ethics 2000 discussions, and in many instances has been adopted by other states. Again, I don't think it would be productive for me to go through the materials that I've provided to you. In the supplemental materials, I tried to give you kind of an outline of the documentation, the background for the rule change, the reasons for the rule change, and the information that supported those changes. Let me make a couple of comments about the proposed Rule 5.5 and then respond to some of the other submittals. Rule 5.5 is the unauthorized practice of law rule, and as this Court is well aware, a very difficult rule. The MJP Working Group presented a recommendation to the Board of Governors in concept back in 2004, then in final draft in late 2005, early 2006, before the submittals to you. The working group is proposing that Rule 5.5 be amended to allow for the occasional practice of law by non-licensed lawyers, non-Wisconsin licensed lawyers in the state of Wisconsin, with certain exceptions and requirements for that occasional practice. Those requirements are that it would only apply in four circumstances, and actually five, but there are four exceptions to the unauthorized practice of law. One is if the lawyer is engaged in representation of a client in association with a Wisconsin licensed lawyer who actively participates in the matter. Two, if the matter that the out-of-state or non-licensed lawyer is providing representation is a matter that the lawyer will either has been or will become admitted pro hac vice, that would be an exception. Three, if it is a matter related to an alternate dispute resolution procedure and is in effect part of the practice of that lawyer. Or four, and I do point out number four is a very broadly written provision, which would basically provide that you could come into Wisconsin on an occasional basis to represent a client if the representation is reasonably related to the lawyer's practice in the jurisdiction where the lawyer is licensed. If that is a catch-all provision, it is a broadly drafted provision, and it is drafted similar to the model rule. The Wisconsin proposed 5.5 would create an exception for services that are provided for a client in the state of Wisconsin that are services that a government lawyer is authorized to provide in the state of Wisconsin by operation of federal law. But the exception we have proposed to you would not apply to non-government lawyers providing services under federal law.
Now, sir, why do you make that exception? When I read the materials, I was kind of surprised because I know a number of people that have federal practices right, where they really aren't in state courts, but they move among the federal courts throughout our states.
Yes. Justice, was a topic of a lot of debate before the working group. And during the time that we were debating this topic, and also since then, as I monitored this issue, there has been a lot of controversy regarding practitioners who engage solely or exclusively in the practice of federal law. Example being immigration, another example being bankruptcy. The circumstances that have arisen have been immigration lawyers who come into another state, establish an office in another state, engage in just the practice of federal law in that state, but only are subject to the regulatory authority of the state where they are licensed. The example that I've been reading about and following is the case of an immigration lawyer in Florida that is licensed only in New York and is only subject to the jurisdiction of the New York regulatory agencies. And when we drafted this, and I realize this is a narrow drafting as compared to the model rule drafting, we said the exception should apply for government practice, but it should not apply for a non-government lawyer who, even though they're engaged in the federal practice, practicing just federal law, even though they're doing just that, if they're doing it in the state of Wisconsin, they should be subject to the jurisdiction of the state of Wisconsin. The four exceptions would allow that person to fall into the categories of one of the four exceptions, and we felt that gave better protection to the public than having somebody with a blanket ability to come into Wisconsin, set up an office, engage in the federal practice of law without any regulatory protection.
What if they didn't set up an office? I'm familiar with two people who have a practice that is solely in federal court in two different subject matter areas. The main office is in New York, but they practice in every federal court where a claim arises that the clients they represent are sued. So if they don't have an office in Wisconsin, would you still think they need to be licensed in Wisconsin to practice in our federal court for that client?
They would qualify under the pro hac vice exception in C.
But then they have to be admitted pro hac vice in federal court, so they wouldn't be able to practice without it.
They would qualify. If it's a matter involving pro hac vice and practice in the court, they'd be admitted pro hac vice. If, in fact, they're giving legal advice, it would qualify under C-4 as relating to their practice.
So these people are in litigation, so they're in court when they're in another state.
And then we would, and in our discussions, our view would be that they would then have the exception of the pro hac vice status, and they should follow that exception.
Does this run into any federal questions? Supremacy?
There are a series, Madam Chief Justice, of questions regarding the federal jurisdiction is questions far beyond the scope of this proceeding involving privilege and things of that nature. We have always understood, and in our discussions, we felt that for purposes of providing representation on and providing advice regarding federal law issues, if they're in an office in Wisconsin, they should be subject to the Wisconsin rules of professional conduct.
Counselor, won't this get our lawyers that have federal practice that are licensed in Wisconsin into difficulties with other states that require some type of reciprocity in order for our lawyers to be able to practice in their federal courts? I think the Minnesota rules said if you let us do it, we'll let you do it. It's that sort of thing.
That's what our rule says as well.
Yeah, all right. But since we have this provision that excludes private lawyers, other states that would have permitted our lawyers to practice there under their rules may no longer do that. So aren't we putting a burden on our Wisconsin lawyers?
But the position of the working group, and we believe that this is applicable to every situation, is that Wisconsin lawyer would be allowed to do the practice in another state because that state lawyer is allowed to do the practice in Wisconsin under paragraph C, either paragraph C-2 relating to pro hac vice or paragraph C-4 relating to arising out of their practice. So they would be allowed to do the same thing. It just doesn't give that wide open. If you're dealing with federal law, you can do anything you want. Now, our reason for viewing it that way is because the notion of the federal law and how the federal law has been interpreted, and perhaps interpreted in a variety of ways by practitioners, leaves that open to a lot of debate. And we thought that the protections under C, which allow that lawyer from another state to come in, would still apply and would give the protection that the lawyer coming in needs, and our lawyer going out, but also gives the regulatory authority to this court.
I have some questions, and I view them as generically sort of unfair when you get a petition, and then what the questioner says is, why didn't you include the following? You know, rather than focusing on what is, but I'm going to do that to you anyway, recognizing that. Okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
The concept of house counsel is not in this. And that's sort of an issue that the court has faced on and off over the years and is not really faced. My understanding of what's happening is if you're house counsel, you can be house counsel. I mean, if you have to go into court, you got another problem. But as long as you stay out of court and give all the advice you want to all the people within the corporation, you don't have to be licensed in Wisconsin. That's my understanding of what's really happening. Is that your understanding?
Your Honor, I have that understanding primarily from dicta from this court, and I do want to
But I think that's what's actually happening on the ground.
I would agree. I would agree.
And nobody's gone after them as practicing law without a license. I mean, that's my point. Okay. And it seems to me that it's tied in with all of this and perhaps should be addressed.
If I may, Your Honor,
yeah.
I'd like to address that and bring several points to the court. First of all, I want the court to know that during the course of our review of this matter, we did include on our working group an in-house counsel attorney who participated in our discussions. And in addition, we did receive a submittal
from the
Association of Corporate
yeah.
Counsel during our discussions. You have received a submittal at this time as well from the court, but that was presented to us during our discussion as well.
And it's in our file,
yes.
And the court has gotten copies of that. Right.
The reason that the very broad exception of the model rule relating to in-house counsel is not in our proposal is, one, because at the time we completed our study, we recommended that a limited license concept be adopted by the Wisconsin Supreme Court as part of the state bar bylaws. The State Bar Association has gone through an extensive review of its bylaws. That has not been presented to this court, and it was my recommendation to the Board of Governors that we proceed with our petition here because, frankly, this issue is being addressed in a lot of places, and I think Wisconsin needs to be part of it. This issue of in-house counsel or sole employer counsel is a question that constantly comes up on the ethics hotline. As a result, the State Bar, through the President-elect, has appointed a special committee to look at this issue of the licensure of in-house counsel. That committee includes members of the Committee on Professional Ethics, the Board of Bar Examiners, the Office of Lawyer Regulation, the Corporate Counsel Committee of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and the Wisconsin chapter of the Association of Corporate Counsel. We are meeting to review this issue and to discuss the pros and cons of how this issue should be addressed. The notion under Model Rule 5.5 is to have anyone who serves as in-house counsel or sole employer counsel can engage in the practice of law in Wisconsin solely for that particular employer. That would be the gist of the model rule exception. That may be what would come to this court after this committee had looked at this issue. I would offer to you additional considerations. Number one, the regulatory agency of the Supreme Court would have jurisdiction over in-house counsel under the model rule language, potentially under language that would be before you. If you adopt the model rule language, which simply allows this as a blanket exception, there really is going to be no procedure for assessing a cost of the regulatory process. If that particular in-house counsel is engaged in the practice of law in Wisconsin, as any other lawyer, they should be, I think, responsible for some of the regulatory cost, as we all are. Secondly, if you engage in the practice of law as in-house counsel under Model Rule 5.5 exception, in theory, the time that you spend as in-house counsel does not count, and this is how it's been interpreted in other jurisdictions, does not count toward being able to be admitted through admission by motion. Under our rules, you have to have engaged in the practice of law in a state where you're licensed for a period of time in order to be admitted by the motion process. If you go with the Rule 5.5 exception, now that may be what this group recommends, but this would cause an in-house attorney who spends 10 years working for a corporation in Wisconsin not getting credit for that 10 years of service. So I think that's something that the corporate counsel should take a look at. And I think I submitted something very recently to the court summarizing how this issue is being addressed on a national level. 26 states have adopted some type of limited license procedure. 24 states have not adopted a limited license procedure. I think this is something that should be addressed with a more thorough review. And frankly, with input from the corporate counsel that are affected by this. I spoke with the corporate counsel committee yesterday for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and they have agreed to participate on this special committee. My impression, and this is please only an impression, was that they were not well attuned to the topic. And I think there needs to be some review and study of the topic. As you may know, this was a matter of a public presentation in a media coverage about 8 months ago in Milwaukee. It did not get a lot of media coverage after that, a little bit to my surprise. But Your Honor, at this point, we believe that the better route to go is to look at this issue and come up with a reasoned approach as to how we handle in-house counsel, rather than simply adopting the Rule 5.5 model rule exception.
I looked at, none of these pages are numbered, which makes it pretty hard, but in your tab 2, mm-hmm. when I scanned it, I don't pretend I've read all of it carefully as I scanned it. Iowa has a registration of lawyers licensed elsewhere who represent organizations here and has an amnesty period for them. And I don't know what all that means, but I did recognize that, which leads me to another issue. And that is, I think a lot of the complexity here in a lot of the number of lawyers that might have to come within Pro Hoc Vici could really be more simply addressed. I don't have the number, so I could be dead wrong. More simply addressed by a rule that says if you are, and I'm using words that have within themselves problems, in good standing, and have practiced law in the last 3 out of 5, 5 out of 7, whatever you want in that, can be admitted as licensed lawyers in the state. We have a very peculiar reciprocal licensing law that BBE has complained about since it was adopted. And others have complained about, and no one brings in a rule change, and you don't have one either. But if you allow people who are licensed in Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, Michigan, I'm just picking states that are surrounding us, and you allow them to become members of the bar, and they pay full freight for everything, and then are regulated by the court, I think you'd have a lot less pro hoc vici. And we get a lot of appellate briefs here where the firm is a Minnesota firm, usually Minnesota, but a licensed Wisconsin lawyer is in that firm and appears as such. Mm-hmm. No pro hoc vici or anything else.
Right.
So have you considered just simplifying reciprocal recognition?
Admission by motion.
Yeah.
Your Honor, we did consider that as part of our submittals to the Board of Governors in roughly December of 2004. Those submittals were received very negatively by the Board of Bar Examiners Executive Director. I personally engaged in some negotiations with the representative from the Board of Bar Examiners and was not successful in bringing together a acceptable procedure for addressing admission by motion. It was therefore my recommendation as chair of the working group that provision be pulled from this petition to the court. And I made that recommendation because, I didn't mean for the court to have to read all these state documents. I just wanted you to have them so you have the background.
I appreciate it because even scanning them gave me several ideas.
Yeah. I really felt, and I recommended to the Board of Governors, that we need to bring this petition forward. 33 states are involved in the temporary or occasional practice of law. I think Wisconsin wants to be in that mix, and so we brought this forward without that. Since then, there has been a change. I certainly think that our group would be very willing to meet with the Board of Bar Examiners and discuss a simplification of the admission by motion process.
Oh, what I was going to ask you is, what was the debate on in this?
The debate was that the executive director of the then executive director of the Board of Bar Examiners was very upset that the proposal that we were presenting broadened or made it easier for admission by motion.
Okay. Do you want to say anything else about reciprocal other than it may be more receptive at the moment?
No, that would be all.
My next comment is one that came up from Colleen Ball, which is in your number 6, I think it is, so you read it. And as you know, Attorney Ball has been very helpful to the court representing the appellate section of the bar, which has just done a wonderful job representing people here who are not, and at the Court of Appeals, who are not represented, and they do that on a pro bono basis. And they've been they may lose, but they've been uniformly good. And we really appreciate that. So what do you have to say about her comments on
We believe court? That the...
And by the way, I have to tell you, I never know what to do, so I always have a motion and I accept it.
Right.
But
we believe that the practice, as understood by Wisconsin lawyers and out-of-state lawyers, is if you are granted pro hoc vice status at the trial court level, that your pro hoc vice status continues throughout the proceedings. We are not aware of specific procedures that are followed to grant pro hoc vice status at the Court of Appeals level or at the Supreme Court level. It is apparently an area that has not been addressed in any rulemaking procedures or in any clarity in that regard.
Well, in light of the fact that the circuit court can govern its procedure, when people appear here, the motion is made, and on behalf of the court, I do grant it. So the concept here, at least as practiced, is you get admitted here pro hoc vice, and that finishes it for that purpose. So that's still a good matter that we might have to put in. Okay. I have my last one, again, deals with something you haven't covered but is obviously in your minds and you are fully aware of the issue, and that is of lawyers outside the United States. Canada, Mexico are immediate neighbors and come to mind, but this involves, and the ABA has a model provision on this. Many states have adopted it, but many have not. And this is broader than the state because legal services are viewed as being covered by GATS and various international trade treaties. And what the Conference of Chief Justices is finding is that the U.S. Trade Representative might be able to make arrangements for foreign lawyers to practice here, because this is all part of services. And the state courts are saying, you know, the United States doesn't have any authority to say who practices in the state court. So we have been negotiating with the U.S. Trade Representative and the ABA and a whole variety of other people who are involved in this. But the general concept, as I understand it,
is that it would be helpful if each state did look at, and I say foreign, not meaning Illinois, lawyers, and how we admit them, because this is a growing problem. Now, we had a petition several years ago that related to foreign lawyers, and the court did not adopt it. But at that time, the court looked at everybody and said, is there a problem? And everybody said, well, not really. And so the court said, no problem, we don't fix it. But I think that day has come and gone. I think at the moment it is a problem. And the Conference of Chief Justices has been dealing with a group of Australian lawyers to show you the significance of this problem, who come to the United States, I'm sure at great expense to somebody, probably not the individual lawyers, to get recognition of Australian lawyers in the United States, whose training and speech and law look very much like ours.
Your Honor, I would respond to that by indicating that I think the issue has come. I'm not sure it's gone in the sense that I think it's still attempting to be resolved. I'm not sure that it's come to a head in the state of Wisconsin.
Not individually as such. I totally agree with you. But it is not limited to either East Coast states or West Coast states. And it is a national issue and a federalism issue. And the question is that we can either get regulated and have a fight with the U.S. Trade Representative and any treaties that are endorsed, or we can be proactive and try and reach this problem here, which doesn't mean necessarily that the federal government is going to do something else. But the general concept is that this is really potentially a good idea that we're going to have to face.
Right. This issue was brought forward in fall of 2004 to the working group. And we discussed it, and we also did kind of a very informal survey regarding whether or not this was an issue that we should address within our petition. At the time, the fall of 2004, we did not feel that this was something we wanted to put into our petition because it had not grown to a point of a burning problem, if you will, in the state of Wisconsin. At that particular time as well, there was a great deal of debate going on in the state of Florida regarding how they should handle this. And I've been watching that debate. Florida has addressed this with a specific rule regarding foreign lawyers. I also believe Washington, D.C. has adopted a rule regarding
New York, too. New York. There have been a number of states.
Yeah, and the thought process at the time by our working group was, let's let some other states kind of wrestle this thing through and find out how they wrestle it through and how they come to a conclusion on it and then visit it for our state, recognizing that we did not feel at the time it was something that was required an immediate review for our particular rule at that time.
My guess is that you've got lawyers from outside the country, probably European Union lawyers, who are coming into the state, working with American Wisconsin lawyers in dealing with how their clients can conduct business under the laws of the foreign country. Mm-hmm. And that since you don't get into court, it's not highly visible. Mm-hmm. And that it takes your chances on somebody objecting and that they're giving advice. I mean, that's my guess. Do I know that it's happening? No, I do not.
No.
But that's my guess.
I believe, Your Honor, that is correct. The example I would point to, Your Honor, although I can't speak for all of the industry, but I know the paper industry today in Wisconsin has become purchased in many instances by foreign national organizations, and they are retaining local counsel, I know that for a fact, on some of the Wisconsin-type issues, but I'm certain that that's something that's going to continue to grow.
Yeah, because they're going to bring in their own lawyers in terms of dealing with with this business abroad. And we have in Wisconsin, as you very well know, Kikamon, who uses local counsel, and local counsel goes to Japan with some frequency. And Japan is not happy with the United States that their lawyers have very limited ability in some states to come in and give advice about Japanese law without running a risk, even though it's small. So I just wanted to bring that out.
And as I said, it was considered, but at the time that we made our report and recommendation, we really felt the issue had not risen to the level, and some of the other issues that we've discussed here are certainly more critical issues that need to be addressed.
I knew I wouldn't catch you unprepared on these, so I appreciate your comments. Do you have anything else you want to say on this? It's a lengthy document, very detailed, which it has to be. And you've sent the court not only a petition, but your various attachments. And so there. And number two has the references to all these other states. So we appreciate that. Do you want to say anything further? And then we'll ask.
I would like to, if I may, just add two more comments regarding the discussion on in-house counsel. And the two points I'm going to raise to you are points that are a matter of debate, if I may use the word, amongst ethicists across this country. So I am not presenting to you an answer. But as it relates to the issue of in-house counsel, one concern we will bring to this group, if that is allowed, is going to be the issue of malpractice as it relates to a lawyer who is licensed in another state but engaged in the practice of law in Wisconsin without being licensed or without having any type of limited license. The second is a very fascinating debate about attorney-client privilege and attorney-client confidentiality. If, in fact, someone is engaged in providing legal representation to a sole employer organization and may serve as legal counsel and vice president of administration or something of that particular title, there's a serious question as to whether the conversations between the president and the vice president are attorney-client privileged or attorney-client confidential if that individual is not licensed in that particular state. The so-called ethicists have not resolved that issue, but that is another reason why we think this really needs to be discussed and looked at as a way to decide exactly what is the best way to handle the in-house counsel licensure matter.
That issue sort of rings a bell and see if I can come up. Isn't that one of the problems with the relatively new federal legislation, that counsel view it as interfering with the privilege?
There is a lot of debate regarding the privilege and the federal legislation at various levels attacking the privilege.
Right.
And in fact, there's a lot of lobbying going on.
The House counsel, but generally.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Barr following this?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is something that is going to be brought forward with this working group or this special committee.
Questions?
One other area I noticed that you depart from the ABA, we were earlier talking about that, is in dealing with good standing. The proposed Wisconsin rule, I think, refers to lawyers in good standing, which isn't part of the ABA rule. And perhaps you can, if you're able to, reference that. I think with regard to Pro Hoc Vici, I'm talking about.
Ah, okay.
I'm sorry. We had a case. We had a case involving, within the last 3 years, how's that, involving a lawyer who I think had not kept current on his CLE or dues or something, and therefore was not perhaps a lawyer in good standing in Wisconsin, but then got admitted pro hoc vice in Colorado. And that was the kind of fact situation.
Using his Wisconsin.
I think so. He's using his Wisconsin. And maybe there's nothing more to be said, but that caught my eye, that the Wisconsin rule refers to lawyers in good standing.
Under the proposed rule that we bring forward to the court, we have adopted what I believe to be the intentions of the model rule, which speak to not being disbarred or suspended from practice in any jurisdiction, as in effect the language that would substitute for being in good standing. That concept of not disbarred or suspended from practice is more specific, but the intent in much of the draft of the pro hoc vice rule is to follow the model rule on pro hoc vice as proposed by the ABA. And really, other than the first paragraph, that's what we tried to do. I acknowledge that it's more specific, but we believe it will more comport with the rules that other states will be adopting.
One trick, I've got a couple of questions. One of them has to do with your choice of occasional practice rather than temporary. And I understand to some extent why you've done that, but I wonder if that's wise, because it sounds as if the states that have adopted the model rule have used temporary, and so that we would be able to draw on precedent in that regard. What's your response to that, sir?
That I anticipated would be a question and tried to address it in my supplemental submittal, and I will admit to this court that it was hard to put on paper what the thought process was of our working group. And so I will try to do this again and orally and see if I can help this court understand. We debated and discussed this a lot, and the notion of occasional is intended to create the atmosphere, for lack of better words, I apologize for those words, to create the atmosphere or understanding that this is not to be something that arises regularly and routinely. Now, the rule says that you can't establish an office, you can't hold yourself out as being a licensed Wisconsin lawyer. But the temporary concept, we felt, would suggest to somebody, well, if I do it for 3 months, that's temporary, because that's not a full year. So our view, after a lot of discussion, was that the temporary could be interpreted by the reading lawyer, whether Wisconsin or not Wisconsin, as giving the right to have a continuous presence for a temporary period of time. And we wanted to make the distinction that this is supposed to be an occasional representation of a particular matter for a particular client. Other states have adopted the occasional language instead of the temporary language, and the analysts or the interpreters in those states have said occasional is more narrow than temporary. So that is supportive of what we were trying to do with this rule. I do acknowledge that this would be a shade different than the model rule.
I had a question in the same area, but the concern or question I have, when you have rules, you occasionally need to have enforcement. And that is where I, when you change from temporary to occasional, I'm trying to set up you have a corporation, and I think, or a client, that wants to use this lawyer on a regular basis, I mean when they have problems, which could be interpreted, but regular would be over, say, I'll just pick 5 years. He's the only counsel that they use, and they use him on an occasionally regular basis. In other words, what I'm getting at is how do you, if there's a relationship between a company and someone they want to represent them, who is not in Wisconsin, I'm just throwing that out for how it seems to be amorphous. It seems to be something that would be very difficult to enforce.
We believe, Justice, that the notion of occasional creates the requirement that it be an individual representation, whereas temporary creates this notion of this is the attorney that we're going to use whenever we have something in Wisconsin, and that person can engage in an ongoing representation for a period of time because it's only temporary. Because there's an admission or a statement by counsel, well, I know they're only going to have me represent them for 6 months on anything that comes in during that six-month period. Appreciate that's a difficult concept, but that was the intent of our
I was
change.
Only bringing up as problems come up for the client, then they would be able to, as I understand it, retain and have that particular lawyer represent them for a number of years. I mean, that's the way I look at it. There's nothing, I'm not saying this is Jerry Steinfeld, there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just trying to see where your outer edges are.
And I believe in a case like that where an attorney has a standing client relationship with an out-of-state client, and they're going to come in to Wisconsin, they're going to do it on a case-specific basis. That could happen for 20 years, as long as it's on a case-specific basis, and we think occasional is a better descriptor of that situation.
Mr. Dietrich, the other question that I had, and maybe you're not the one to address this, but it had to do with David Schwartz's comments having to do with the pro hoc vice situation as far as administrative tribunals. He seems to have, at least on paper, a rather valid point that the process seems a little too complicated for the administrative hearings. Can you address that issue?
I have not. I can address the issue, and I will do so, Justice. I have not seen the specific submittal, but I would like to speak to that issue. There is simply no process now. And the administrative law judges that I've spoken to over the years in addressing this simply stand confused. Is there a procedure currently for a Illinois attorney to come in and handle a unemployment compensation hearing for a Wisconsin client or an Illinois client? There is no procedure at this point in time. The proposal as it relates to pro hoc vice, as it relates to administrative agencies, again, comes from the model rule on pro hoc vice. And as I'm sure this court knows, the notion here, I'm not sure how successful we are all going to be across this country, but the notion here is to have as uniform a rule as possible. It will be very easy, and the State Bar certainly will develop a form that anybody can use. It'll be a downloadable form from the website that somebody can fill out and use as part of the admission process for pro hoc vice. My final response is that this provides a procedure to address pro hoc vice and administrative agencies. There is none now, and currently the administrative law judges are pretty confused as to what they can and cannot allow in regards to appearances before ALJs and administrative proceedings.
His point seemed to be, and it's too bad that you weren't provided with that.
It came in April 9th.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why, obviously. But in any case, his point seemed to be that it was going to be expensive. It was going to be a little more complex than necessary. And that the idea ought to be that the administrative law judge could just decide, as a circuit judge could now, to admit pro hoc vice. So I'm only saying that to summarize for you his point.
Yeah. And again, part of my response would be the intent to have a model rule or a model procedure. I would like to respond to the issue of expense. We are proposing that a fee be established for purposes of pro hoc vice admission. Please understand, as I know this court does, that what this involves is the regulatory process, the regulation of lawyers. Again, it is difficult to understand how it would be that a lawyer from Illinois could come into Wisconsin, engage in a proceeding, whether administrative or circuit court proceeding, be subject to the regulatory process, be subject to the jurisdiction of this court and the Office of Lawyer Regulation, but yet Wisconsin lawyers are to pay that cost.
How much the fee is and who gets it.
The fee would primarily be an administrative cost fee, and we would work with OLR to establish what would be some sort of a fee that would be appropriate to contribute toward the regulatory process, whatever administrative cost there would be to keep the materials and track the materials, and that would be it.
Counselor, how do you square that with what I understand to be the current practice that non-lawyers routinely appear before our administrative agencies in hearings?
Justice, I can't square that. I can give you two answers.
It goes on.
Absolutely goes on a daily basis. The only thing that I can answer first is to say that there are some who would say that that's not the practice of law. I don't profess to be that one of that type, but some would say that that's not the practice of law. Others would say that we simply don't have a system in place, both to have jurisdiction over that lawyer that comes in and appears before an administrative agency and is not licensed in Wisconsin, nor do we have a system to even document that took place. So there is nothing now to allow us to capture that from an administrative perspective. And with regards to Pro Hoc Vice, for the most part, Pro Hoc Vice conduct of lawyers has been overseen by the circuit court rather than by the Office of Lawyer Regulation. So I am unable to square that.
Because that would be it would be unequal treatment of those many Wisconsin corporations who routinely just send in their accountant or their bookkeeper or their whatever they want to have represent them, not an officer of the corporation, not a director of the corporation. They appear all the time. Yet we are asking those folks that come from out of state and our lawyers to jump through considerably more hoops. I think it's a problem, but...
Well, but of course, Justice, the lawyer that represents the business at that proceeding, from the Wisconsin licensed lawyer.
Their lawyers don't appear many times. There is no lawyer. The company is represented by an employee who may be an accountant, who may be the business manager, who may be a lot of things, but not a lawyer.
Right. But there also are proceedings where a Wisconsin licensed lawyer appears and an Illinois licensed lawyer appears, and there are differences there as well.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
This raises an even bigger issue, and I'm throwing it out to you because you're ongoing. I hope you're ongoing in dealing with these issues. So a lawyer comes by, and I see him, and he says, you know, I do investment advice and counseling and it's part of estate planning. So do a lot of other people in town. And they're not lawyers, and they don't have to be lawyers, because part of their profession is also investment advice, counseling, estate planning. And I'm a member of the Wisconsin Bar. Now, if I do something that's seriously wrong, I'm going to be before OLR in this court. If that other guy who isn't a licensed lawyer does something seriously wrong, might have a malpractice lawsuit, but not the license is not going to be lifted and can go on and continue. And so his colleagues say to him, that's easy. Just drop out of being a member of the bar and do what you're doing anyway. And you'll save yourself some bucks during the year and you don't have to go do CLE and everything else. And that doesn't sound fair to me, he says to me, and that you should do something about that. I said, I'm going to tell Dean Dietrich.
First, Chief Justice, I was the author now about 4 years ago, 3 years ago, of an article that has, in some instances, come back to haunt me, but I do believe it was sound advice, which said that you are a lawyer 24/7. And there are issues if somebody drops their law license and engages in, things that would perhaps be defined as the practice of law without having the background of being a lawyer but not having the law license. And I don't think we've worked through all those. I think the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court have tried to look at the issue of the unauthorized practice of law. And we have said we'll look at it some more, because it is a complex issue, that one that has troubled many states. I'm sure this court is aware, for example, of Nevada, that has about 12 pages worth of a definition of the practice of law. And it is extremely a difficult issue. Part of the scenario you described is part of our privilege and our responsibility as a lawyer. If we are going to be a lawyer and we're going to be licensed and we're going to be able to say we're a lawyer, then we're subject to those rules of professional conduct 24/7. And if we do something wrong, we should pay the consequences, even though the person in the office next to us down the hall does the same thing wrong and all they are is a certified financial planner and they don't lose that certification. That comes with what our position is as a lawyer.
Thank you. Justice Prosser.
Mr. Dietrich, Rule 10.03(4), as it presently exists, is small type about this big. And I see there are, what is it, 4 or 5 pages? And plus an appendix. Now, is it your position this is, you're just following in lockstep with the ABA?
My position is twofold, Justice. Position number one is that this has its primary source, the model rule on pro hoc vice admission, and it is the goal of the ABA, and I believe should be the goal of this court to be in sync with what other states do, and the ABA is requesting and suggesting this be adopted by other states. But my position is also this, Justice. That little paragraph is all that we have today in the form of guidance for how we handle pro hoc vice admissions and how we handle pro hoc vice administration. And that means every trial court does it differently. At the present time today, I could not give you one statistic as to how many pro hoc vice admissions there are. I am aware anecdotally of a number of problems with pro hoc vice admission practitioners, but those are all speculation at this point. We simply have really no system to address pro hoc vice admission but for that single paragraph. And I believe that it is in the best interest of the bar, it is in the best interest of the courts, and it is in the best interest of the public that there be some body to the process of pro hoc vice admission. In particular, I think there should be some oversight by the regulatory agencies of the court.
Well, I'd like to sort of follow up on the questions that Justice Crooks was asking about cost. Let's say an Indiana attorney comes into Wisconsin and is admitted pro hoc vice in some kind of a tort case. What is the practice for the local counsel at the association there?
Under the exclusive jurisdiction of the trial court, it is what the trial court requires. And what I mean by that, Justice, is some trial court judges will require that the Wisconsin lawyer be actively engaged in the representation, appear at depositions, and appear at proceedings. Other trial court judges say, as long as you make an entrance of an appearance, that's all that the court's going to require as far as participation of the Wisconsin lawyer. Now, we do have a Supreme Court rule under Chapter 20 that says if you're sharing fees with another lawyer, you're to be responsible for the ethical responsibilities, if you will, of that other lawyer if you're sharing fees. Each of those are individually determined based upon the arrangements. But absent that requirement under 1.5E, I believe, 20:1.5E, there is no guidance. And it's up to the individual trial court as to what the role will be of that Wisconsin lawyer.
Well, I think one of the points that Mr. Schwartz makes is that part of the cost that seems somewhat unrealistic in, say, a workers' comp, well, maybe an unemployment comp case mm-hmm. with an attorney from out of state, to have that association with local counsel, if in fact local counsel has to actually show up there
mm-hmm.
or really participate, this is a much lower, less money involved, and it just doesn't make sense. Response?
Yes, Justice. My response doesn't answer the point, though. I do not have a resolution to, and I'll use the word tension because I think that's a less onerous word, the tension between administrative agencies designed to be cost-effective, and there are practitioners who are non-lawyers that are very effective in administrative proceedings, and the definition of, or this court's view of, the practice of law. I don't know how to square that tension. If you are saying to me that in a case of an administrative proceeding, because those are less costly, because the legal issues addressed are very narrow and specific, or because there are individuals who are trained in handling those types of cases, who are non-lawyers, that therefore we should not have a requirement of pro hac vice and Wisconsin lawyer participation in that proceeding, an administrative agency proceeding, but we're still going to have that requirement for a circuit court proceeding, I think you're then reaching a conclusion that one type of law is lesser than another type of law. Now, to me, that's a difficult tension, and I have a very difficult time squaring that. But I engage in administrative practice, administrative agency practice a lot, and much of my practice is against non-lawyers. And that does happen. And I don't know how to square that. We are allowing non-lawyers to be engaged in that type of activity. We have not said that, at least at this point, we have not said that that's the practice of law. Or if we have, it certainly hasn't been enforced. And Justice, I can't square that. I cannot square that tension. It is very difficult.
Mr. Schwartz, who is the administrator of the State of Wisconsin Division of Hearings and Appeals, his suggestion is very much the same, as I read it, as Steve Levine's is, namely, go back to what has worked for 3.5 decades, so that you just let the hearing examiner, just like you let the circuit court judge, allow in on his or her discretion foreign lawyers. I gather, and I did not go back and read this case, that what happened in 2004 in a case that was from this court, we said that the statutes only grant pro hoc vici authority to circuit courts and not to hearing examiners. And so if you find confusion, I might suggest it might be due to that case, because at least he says prior to that case it was quite clear. They just did it. And then he says he checked around, and then no one had any problems, and he's not had any difficulties on this. And according to his statistics, across the state, they hire something like, they hear like us, DHA handled over 17,000 cases in calendar year 2005, and in 2006, received over 18,000 case referrals from the agencies, and they conduct well over 90% of the administrative hearings that occur in this state. They have 30 hearing examiners that hear cases in every county. So that's a lot of cases. I mean, I'm assuming many, if not most, are non-lawyers on both sides, but I don't know that.
I would first acknowledge, Chief Justice, that many of the cases are non-lawyers on both sides. I am so pleased that the court gets to wrestle with this tension and not me, but I will again express it to you. It is not uncommon for me to appear on behalf of a Wisconsin corporation in an unemployment compensation hearing on behalf of the Wisconsin corporation. It is not common in Wausau because we're in the center of the state, but it is not uncommon in the border cities to have an Illinois lawyer appearing at that same proceeding on behalf of the employee. And as you know, under the current manner in which things are handled, not only is there no procedure for that lawyer to appear, but currently there is no procedure for oversight of the regulation of the conduct of that particular lawyer. Now, if you look at a case where it involves a non-lawyer appearing and another non-lawyer, well, maybe those are the same then. Maybe that's not a problem. Or if it's a non-lawyer representing the Wisconsin client and it's an attorney from another state representing the other client, maybe that's not a concern. But where I sit is on the issue of the Wisconsin lawyer and the Illinois lawyer, both at the hearing, both doing the same thing. And currently there are no procedures either for admission or for oversight. Now, some of that oversight would have come from this Rule 5.5, because there would be coverage, perhaps under C4, if it's not a proceeding that involves pro hoc vice admission, and if it's not, that wouldn't be an administrative agency, in my opinion, would not be an alternate dispute resolution, but it would fall under C4. Now there may be regulation, or at least the ability to exercise regulation and exercise Wisconsin rule regulation under the rules that we are proposing. Again, there is a tension there.
Any other comments? Questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Diedrich.
Thank you.
The other presenter is, the other appearance is by Steve Levine. Mr. Levine. Mr. Levine, the court has your comments, and they're under tab 3 of the bar submission.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Steve Levine. I'm president of the State Bar, although I'm appearing for myself this morning. I first want to say that this is a very unusual situation for me, because it's one of those very rare instances where I disagree with something that the Board of Governors is proposing to this court. I greatly respect the work and the time that has been put into these proposed rules, but I come to them from a totally different perspective than the bar comes. And that perspective is that, you well know, the practice of law is changing. There's more national law. There's more international law. And I believe that the kind of rules concerning MJP that this court should adopt should be rules that facilitate and encourage and make as least expensive as possible interstate and international practice of law. And I think, unfortunately, that these rules do exactly the opposite. And I have four brief comments that I'd like to make. First of all, the proposed pro hoc vice rule. The rule is not based on any study that was done by the state bar of circuit court judges or administrative hearing examiners to indicate that there's any problem that the currently existing rule is insufficient to cover. The rule as proposed by the state bar complicates the current practice, which is simply a matter of discretion with circuit court judges, by imposing a very complex application procedure. It imposes a cost that isn't there now. If anything, this is going to discourage rather than encourage the interstate practice of law. Speaking from my own personal experience of 32 years of administrative proceedings, this would be disastrous. It would cause increased delay in administrative proceedings, delay where the attorney would have to fill out a complex application, which I looked at the application and the information that's required. I wouldn't even know half of the information that's asked for in this application, you know, in my own personal resume. So this is going to cause a great deal of problems, particularly in the administrative field. And the hearing examiner is going to have to read this over. Plus, the cost that's imposed is going to be passed on to the client and ultimately to the public. Again, I would just emphasize the idea that the court should adopt MJP rules which facilitate and make as easy and inexpensive as possible the multi-state practice of law. And this pro hoc vice rule goes in exactly the opposite situation. I would also encourage the court to adopt the model rule on in-house counsel practice. It's a one-paragraph, simple rule. I've seen the rule that the working committee is studying, and it's the same type of rule as the pro hoc vice rule. It's 3 pages long. It has sub-paragraphs. It's complicated. It involves applications. It involves fees that have to be paid. Why not adopt a rule that's going to be as simple as possible and encourage, again, the interstate practice of law with in-house counsel? I would also encourage the court to adopt the model rule when it comes to federal practice. I think the case law makes clear, both federal case law, and I think it's almost 45 years ago that the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Keller case that came out of this court that said that when it comes to appearances before federal agencies, that's a matter of federal law, and that it's not up to state courts to decide that. So I think there's going to be some jurisdictional and comedy problems if the federal rule is adopted the way it is right now. Finally, I would encourage the court to adopt a rule which allows attorneys, wherever they're admitted to practice, to represent Wisconsin clients if it's in an area of national practice, or practice that doesn't differ from state to state, securities law, labor law, perhaps social security disabilities law. Leave the choice of the attorney to the client. If it's an area of law that doesn't differ from state to state, why not promote truly national practice?
How do you do that?
Pardon?
How do you do that? Are you going to want to admit them to the bar, or just say they can come in and do it?
Let an attorney who's in Illinois or Minnesota or anywhere in the country who wants to advertise and get clients in a national area of law, let them advertise in Wisconsin and have a client in Wisconsin.
Now, not be members of the bar.
Right.
Okay.
Again, I come at these rules from the perspective of asking the court to adopt rules which are going to be easy, which are going to be efficient and as inexpensive as possible to promote and encourage the interstate and the international practice of law. If the court has any questions, I'd be glad to answer. Also, Mr. Schwartz, his name has come up in the discussion several times before, is in the courtroom today, and he asked me to tell the court that he'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Good. Mr. Schwartz? Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Levine? Justice Brasser?
I frankly don't know what I don't know how the law presently deals with pro hac vice attorneys who do something unethical when they are in Wisconsin. Are they proceeded under by against by OLR in any way, or what happens to them?
I don't know. I've never heard of a situation. I don't know if one has ever come up. As I say, in my 30-some years of practicing in the administrative area, there's never been a problem that I've seen at all with out-of-state attorneys who have appeared in administrative proceedings. I don't know. Maybe you could find out from OLR whether there have been any complaints about it.
Well, even in court. But what happens if they do something in court?
Again, I don't know what the experience has been. I assume that, you know, any attorney, whether they're admitted to practice in Wisconsin or not, if they practice here, they subject themselves to the jurisdiction of OLR in this court. And I assume that that if there's a problem with them, they can be referred to OLR.
Yeah, Mr. Levine, I think it's known that you don't favor a bar that all attorneys have to be members of.
Well, that's not my main concern about these rules.
But I mean, that is the law. It is the law. We all have to be members of the bar. And how do you reconcile something that, frankly, sounds pretty good to me in many respects, but how do you reconcile what you're talking about with the fact that everybody else has to pay for regulation and the support of the bar and the institution, and other people just come in, out, and they don't have to pay?
But as long as these attorneys are admitted somewhere, they're paying, you know, in the state that they're admitted. An attorney whose main practice isn't in Wisconsin, I mean, what cost does an individual who might appear one or two or three times in Wisconsin a year, what cost do they really impose on the system?
Well, I know for a long time I never made as much money from the practice of law as my bar dues, because I didn't practice law. And it just kind of, there's something sticks in my craw that people could come in, make huge amounts of money, but never contribute anything to the bar, and certainly not as much as I was contributing to the bar. I mean, that sentiment, is at least one member of the bar has that sentiment.
I guess my only answer would be they're contributing somewhere. Whatever bar they're a member of, they're contributing in that state.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Schwartz, do you want to say anything? Here's your big chance. We only read your opinions.
I don't think that the world is going to come to an end if the bar enacts the rule with regard to administrative agencies. Either way, I think that we'll continue on going and conducting our caseload and be able to work, because there aren't that many situations where non-state attorneys practice. However, it just seems that that the bar didn't look totally at the full breadth of the type of cases that we conduct administratively in the state. We send, in addition to doing things like licensing power plants and issuing very complicated air pollution rules, we conduct all the hearings for people who have benefits such as food stamps and Medicaid. These people, we hold in these proceedings, hearing examiners will come in and maybe schedule 12 to 16 cases in a day, And the idea that in some of these cases where they bring in either a family member or somebody who is an out-of-state lawyer who happens to be do their work in some other context, it just seems like it's just way overkill as to the amount of procedure that the State Bar is proposing here. A simple rule that allows the administrative law judge or the hearing examiner to consider whether this person is qualified to represent the person, I think, is more than adequate for purposes of protecting the public, and certainly would benefit the process and allow the citizenry to have their access to the judicial system. And frankly, given the numbers, and the numbers that you read, Chief Justice, were just...
Your numbers.
My numbers, they were just from my agency, and that doesn't include the number of unemployment compensation and workers' compensation claims, which brings that number up to over 30,000 cases a year. So, in that context, the idea of bringing in local counsel to have to be there and sitting in a proceeding that is just, it will, in effect, there will be no out-of-state counsel in these proceedings except in the very, very complicated big cases.
Mr. Schwartz, if I could, you've talked about the issue of assessing qualifications. One of the concerns that I think the proposed rule addresses, though, deals with the regulation of problems that may occur. And I'm not certain how the, under the current practice, if you have problems, how that is regulated.
The only way that a hearing examiner could address something like that right now would be to, if after warning the individual, if it was a behavior issue, for instance, of an attorney, they would just bar them from the proceeding. In most cases, that is the most that we can do. If it's an ongoing item, the agency would have to request the Department of Justice to bring an action against that person for their behavior. So that in effect, has never been done to my knowledge.
What about the perspective, though, of the individual who is counting on that representation or counting on that help in this administrative proceeding, and all of a sudden they're in the middle of the proceeding and they find that what they have is not helpful, and they may, in fact, be harmed as a result of this representation? What do we do about that?
I would think that the individual would, the hearing officer would have to try and deal with the individual and try and get them to present their case in the best way that they can do it. That's basically what we do. We're trying to get as much information and fact into the record in as fast a manner as possible. We frequently have, people who are very, very upset at the system because they're not getting their benefits or whatever their situation is. I mean, many of these situations are very charged. And hearing officers, I think, do a really good job of trying to give the person the power, empowerment to present their case, that they are actually being heard, and that in the final decision that will be rendered, that these facts and their considerations are being fully considered for the decisions.
Mr. Schwartz, I've got a question. It relates to the Seitzinger case that you cite. And the suggestion seems to be that since that case and since this court recognized that right now under the law, circuit judges are the ones that decide on pro hoc vice, has that really meant that there are no longer any pro hoc vice admissions in the administrative hearings?
To the best of my knowledge, yes, it does mean that. But that does not mean that there are no out-of-state attorneys practicing at those proceedings.
Explain that, if you will.
Well, as Justice Roganzak pointed out earlier, many people come to administrative proceedings who have people representing them, advocates, family members, whatever, accountants, various forms of individuals who know something specific about these proceedings and represent them. And what ends up happening right now is if somebody would ask me to admit somebody pro hoc vice, I'd say we have no authority to do so. But unless somebody objected and to that person continuing to practice, I would allow that person to do it. And
as a non-lawyer?
As a non-lawyer. And in fact, the one case that I know of where it was shortly after Seitzinger, the hearing officer said, no, you cannot practice, we'll not accept you pro hoc vice, but you can do whatever you want, and if it's a practice of law issue, she said she would leave that to the district attorney to decide whether they wanted to bring an action for practicing law without a license. So I think that is, in effect, what is happening.
Justice Bradley.
As a follow-up to that inquiry, the description has been that there's a tension when non-attorneys can represent parties in administrative proceedings, and the tension with the proposed rule that requires a procedure for pro hoc vice admission for out-of-state lawyers to do this very same thing that the non-lawyers can do. Do you have any comments, and that's a general question, do you have any comments regarding that tension, either how to resolve it or if it needs to be resolved or what to do about it, anything?
I have no answer, but my only response can be that the system was functioning fairly well before the Seitzinger case, and I think that somehow the public in this state, after many years of participation in these proceedings, and many times they are coming in giving just public input in proceedings with regard to lakes and access matters, and they expect to be heard. And whether they come in with their accountant or whoever it is who has information that will lend itself to giving more facts on that situation and hopefully persuading the decision maker to go their way, I don't think it's a big problem. I guess I hate to call it an academic exercise here, but it's something that seems to have been dealt with because the public regularly act in this way. They participate. They want their family member to be able to represent them. They want a lawyer who happens to live in Minnesota where they live, but they have recreational property in Wisconsin, they want that person who they've had a lifelong relationship with to represent them. That I just think is the expectation, and because of the openness of our administrative proceedings, I believe that's the expectation that the public has developed over many years.
Mr. Schwartz, are you going to stay for the next rules petition, which relates to federal administrative law judges?
Absolutely, if you'd like me to, certainly.
If you can, I would, because I'm going to have a question for you about state administrative law judges, and
no
you're
problem.
Just a real find for the court.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much, counsel. Are there any other appearances rules petition 0606. I have a question for you, Mr. Saleen. That's always if you're in the crowd, dangerous. And it was really Justice Prosser's question, which is, do we have any experience with complaints or grievances to the OLR relating to lawyers outside, not licensed in this state, who come in on pro hoc vici or come in on administrative law hearings?
Right. I don't recall any specific grievances relating to pro hoc vici applications. There may be some. that have occurred, but there would not be very many, or with regard to administrative hearings. Now, the rules that we have in Chapter 22 are uniformly clear, and the MJP petition supports this concept that the court would regulate lawyers who are licensed or who practice law in the state. So I think that the jurisdictional authority is adequate. The practice, however, historically, is to take those particular matters when they come in, and again, very few, and I don't recall a single one at this point, and would refer them to the state in which the person is licensed. I don't think that's entirely adequate. We've had some other situations where lawyers not in an administrative proceeding and not pro hac vice might be the subject of some communication with our office saying, this particular attorney is counseling clients in this state or advertising in this state to provide some legal services. The person is really taking advantage of vulnerable people. We could certainly debate the validity of those allegations. And they say, Wisconsin, do something about this. And we say, well, the person's licensed in California. I send a letter to California. California writes me back and says, if you don't care, why do I care what happens to people in Wisconsin? And there we are. But
do you think you have jurisdiction to cover that once they're in here?
I do believe that we have jurisdiction, right. I think I would take a different view in a case where someone was practicing law in Wisconsin and there was a violation of some other ethics rule other than the unauthorized practice rule. I think I would take a harder look at that situation. But then again, I think we're then pressing an issue of jurisdiction which is contrary to our practice, but what I think is clearly provided for in the rule.
What's the penalty? Let's say someone is in here pro hac vice.
Yes.
And they clearly violate some standard. What is the penalty? I mean, I can see your ability to proceed against them, but sure. What would the penalty be?
You can't suspend their practice because they're not licensed here. That's your point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I think you could. And I think there's precedent nationally to do that very thing. And
we
Maryland
could suspend an Illinois license?
Maryland has revoked an attorney who wasn't even licensed in Maryland. Yes. I think you can do it.
But what do you do? What's the penalty you would recommend to a court to impose? And then,
Your Honor, that would depend on the particulars of the case, obviously. But if we're talking about a serious case, it would be foreseeable in my mind to bring you a serious case and say this person is licensed in another state, not licensed here, practicing here, pro hac vice, and is engaged in this misconduct. And that person should have his or her license revoked.
Which license? From another state?
You would have no authority over the other state, but you would just say you're licensed to practice because you practiced here in the state. And that you would just... it's a difficult concept because there is no license in fact. There's no license in form, but there is a license in fact, unless you also conclude it's unauthorized practice of law, which you may, and then you have some theoretical difficulties there. But I know that it's been done in this country where they have suspended or revoked lawyers who are not licensed in that state. It creates some theoretical issues about how we regulate. There are some significant advantages for doing so that protect the public interest. I mean, if I'm that person who receives that discipline from the court, I know that I'm not authorized.
Who would then advise California? And they might care then.
You might take reciprocal action based on that, on that ruling, and that might result in a revocation in California. Or at a minimum, at least I'm telling everybody in Wisconsin. I mean, there's a publication of it with the bar. There's a publication of it in the newspaper. I'm telling people in Wisconsin that there's a problem, that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has decided that discipline was appropriate and that misconduct occurred. So there's value in it, you know, at least in terms of a regulatory function. But it's a very interesting and good question.
Any other questions for Mr. Sling?
Currently under our 20.8.5, and that's what we're really talking about, and at least in part, it seems to me, this
in
choice
part.
Of law regarding discipline and who has the authority to discipline and how does that
Right.
Work, if you will, if someone is either licensed or has, as the statute says, authority to appear on that particular proceeding, which I assume is just other language for pro hac vici. A lawyer authorized by a court of the state to appear and practice in a proceeding in that court is pro hac vici language, I assume, in 20.8.5, is subject to the disciplinary authority of this state for the conduct that occurs in that connection. For the same conduct, a lawyer may be subject to the disciplinary authority of both this state and the other jurisdiction where this lawyer is admitted to the bar. But the question remains, what's the punch? You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right. Thank
you. As I recall, you do have the authority to impose monetary penalties on attorneys?
The rule in 2116 says that the court can impose as a form of discipline a monetary payment in 21.16. Traditionally, that is a restitution order from the court. The court has not adopted a practice of imposing fines as a punitive measure. But the term in the rule is monetary payment.
That might be available for an out-of-state attorney?
I think that the court would be doing something that's not currently part of its precedent in imposing a fine. But again, I'd have to do some research on that to be clear.
Well, it'd be fine.
I'm not prepared for that.
A forfeiture.
Right. Something other than
a real question about criminal jurisdiction.
But certainly, along the lines of your thinking, Justice, you know, a reprimand would certainly have the same kind of effect on me, whether I'm licensed here or not. The suspension creates, and the revocation creates some of the issues, and the monetary payment would be something I'd have to research and do some homework on before I really answered your question.
Thank you, Mr. Saleen. Any other appearances on 0606? Hearing none, the hearing on Rules Petition 0606 relating to the amendment to Chapter 20 is closed. We will now turn to 0609, which is in the matter of the petition of the United States Administrative Law Judges appointed under 5 U.S.C. Section 3105 to amend SCR 10.033R3A. The presenter is the Honorable Ronald G. Bernoski, U.S. Administrative Law Judge and President of the Association of the Association of Administrative Law Judges. Are you president of the Wisconsin chapter or the entire country?
For the entire country, Your Honor. We have our association is organized on a national basis, not by state.
Thank you for appearing today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us. And good morning.
Before you start, I've been derelict. Justice Wilcox had to leave for a funeral. He has left his tentative discussion points on all these issues, so you may proceed.
Okay, thank you. And good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Ron Bernoski, and I'm a federal administrative law judge with the Social Security Administration, and I'm the petitioner in this case. I'm also joined in the petition by four other administrative law judges. We have our offices in the cities of Milwaukee and Madison in the state of Wisconsin. We are all members of the State Bar of Wisconsin as judicial members, but we are not engaged in the private practice of law.
Can I ask you a question? As an administrative law judge in the federal system, do you have to be a member of any particular bar?
Yes.
Okay, so it's a requirement.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
For example, I've been a member of the State Bar of Wisconsin since 1965, if I can remember back that long. And I was practicing in Menominee Falls, which is a suburb of Milwaukee, for about 15 years before becoming an administrative law judge with the Social Security Administration. All of us, the five of us, all reside in the state of Wisconsin, but we are employed by the federal government in a manner similar to that of a United States bankruptcy judge or a United States magistrate judge. The federal government, as you know, has no licensing authority for administrative law judges or for any attorney, for that matter, and it looks to the local and state bar associations for this function. So we are asking the court to continue our judicial status and to amend the administrative rules to specifically include United States administrative law judges as judicial members. We believe that we clearly meet the requirements of being a court of record. We hold hearings that are required by law to be on the record. Our cases can enter the federal court system on appeal and on occasion find their way to the United States Supreme Court by reason of writ of certiorari. We are appointed by, pursuant to federal statute, section 3105 of Title V of the Administrative Procedure Act. This act was adopted in 1946 to ensure the judicial independence of federal administrative law judges. We have what amounts to a lifetime appointment, but we do have a judicial discipline and removal system which provides that administrative law judges can be removed for cause after a hearing before the United States Merit Systems Protection Board. And as I indicated, by law, we hear cases on the record after an opportunity for an agency hearing. Just to give you a brief introduction to administrative law judges, there are about 29 agencies in the federal government that have administrative law judges. Most of the administrative law judges are in the D.C. area, Washington, D.C. area. However, a few agencies have them located throughout the United States. The Social Security Administration is one of those agencies, and we have about 141 hearing offices located throughout the United States.
How many? Are you only five in Wisconsin?
No, in Milwaukee we have 14.
Okay, so it's only the five who signed this. But
correct. The other, okay. we have Illinois lawyers, you know, and one Indiana lawyer. So we have judges that are licensed in other states.
And what about other federal agencies? Do they have administrative law judges in Wisconsin?
No, they do not.
So we're dealing with 14 people, some of whom are licensed in other states.
Correct.
Is that right?
That is correct.
What about, I heard you to say 14 in the Milwaukee office. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Yes, that includes the Madison office.
Okay.
I included that because Madison is really a satellite of Milwaukee. So it's administered through the...
They just watch it.
For the purposes of administrative law for the Social Security Administration. Not for all purposes, of course.
Okay.
And as I indicated, federal administrative law judges hear cases with a wide range of jurisdiction. For example, the administrative law judges hear cases involving federal energy, trade and commerce, banking, agriculture, transportation, labor, Medicare, Social Security, and there are others, of course. Some administrative law judges hear cases of considerable value, and federal energy, for instance. Those cases involve millions of dollars. Our cases, which are primarily Social Security disability cases, have been valued at approximately $250,000 a case, including the Medicare claim. The United States Supreme Court on several occasions has said that federal administrative law judges are, quote, functionally comparable to trial judges. That was said in Butts versus Economule in 1978 and also again in the Federal Maritimes Commission versus South Carolina in 2002. Our functions include holding hearings, taking evidence, issuing subpoenas, ruling on evidence, holding conferences, and rendering decisions based on the evidence of record.
I think that the court will recognize, as you have stated in your petition, that you perform functions that are very comparable to what a circuit court judge does in Wisconsin, or a court commissioner in Wisconsin, or a federal judge. What I'd like you to tell me is why you want this classification. One is dollars. Is that right? I mean, you're going to pay less dues than if you're classified as a lawyer?
I would say that's a secondary. Okay. Secondary. I think our primary concern is to we value the status and classification of being considered a judge. We believe that we are performing a judicial function, and we believe that we deserve this recognition within the state bar, and I think that we are best suited for that classification within the State Bar Association because
you do recognize there's a difference being in the executive branch and in the judicial branch.
As you bring that up, that is true. I wanted to speak to that. We are in the executive branch of the federal government. But the United States Supreme Court, in citing Williams versus the United States, which is a 1933 case, said, and I quote, that the judicial power of the United States is not limited to the judicial power defined under Article 3 of the Constitution and may be exercised by legislative courts.
And a bankruptcy judge is not an Article 3 judge.
No, but it's in the judicial branch.
Okay. Now, my point is this. There are certain consequences that flow from being in that provision as a judge. One consequence is the fee. Another consequence is, I think, that you have different CLE requirements. At least I have to follow CLE requirements for the judges. And then there are requirements within that. Third, I fall within the discipline of, and this doesn't cover it necessarily the federal judges, I fall within the discipline of the Judicial Commission and the Code of Judicial Conduct. I mean, those are the three that I can think of. So I want to know, and there are effects in bar membership, whether it's lawyer or active or inactive or judicial, that flow from the classification. So I want to know what you want to be the consequences to the administrative law judges. Because something that occurred to me is, and I haven't thought it through, I haven't checked with my colleagues, we're waiting here, and I'll ask this to Tom Basting, who was supposed to appear. Maybe there has to be another category, executive branch, judicial hearing officers or administrative law judges. Title seems to vary, and that they should have what particular dues, what particular CLE, and what particular discipline. Do you understand what I'm
saying? I understand
doing?
What you're saying, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, what kind of dues do you want to pay?
Well,
you have a choice from zero to whatever is the maximum dues.
Well, of course, that's for the bar to decide, and we would pay whatever dues they...
You're willing to pay the same dues as the Supreme Court justices?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
That's a full fare.
Absolutely.
All right. And that includes a discipline, that's the OLR assessment, the BBE assessment, the... what's the security fund? I don't know if they have to pay for that, but I think that we do. But
$50.
$50 for pro bono. Okay, that's another. If you feel full fare, at least as for a Supreme Court justice. You see what I'm trying to get at? I want to know how you want to. Doesn't matter to me what you call it. I understand how it matters to you, and I don't mean to denigrate that. But I want to know where you fit in the various consequences of being licensed in this state. Okay, what about CLA? I know you have your own programs. And if they were authorized by the CLA, which there's a way of doing that, and I think it seems to me they would pass, but I'm not in charge of that either. Right. You're willing to do CLA?
Absolutely. In fact, our association provides an annual conference where we have CLE, which is agency-specific training, which we have accredited, as you indicate, through the various states because we meet the requirements. We have the printed materials, the sign-in rosters, the lectures, the 50-minute lectures, everything that meets the requirements of CLE accreditation. Mm-hmm. For the and so, also the and agency
I,
does some
I think it's 30 hours in effect over 2 years. You don't have a problem with that. No. Okay. What about discipline? I assume you do not want to be under the OLR because you have your own discipline system.
Well, to that extent, as far as I see discipline as a kind of a federalized bifurcated system, because we do have our own discipline system under the Merit Systems Protection Board, which can remove, in fact, the administrative law judge from their position. But we also are licensed in states, like we're licensed in the state of Wisconsin, and Wisconsin is the regulatory authority, of course, can discipline any one of its members for reasons and remove that license. So to that extent, we're subject to two masters, if you will.
Okay, so you're open to abiding by the Code of Judicial Conduct and being disciplined accordingly for Wisconsin law.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that that's one of our objectives, is we think that we're more appropriately judged, if you will. The standard is more appropriate for us under the judicial code than it is under the lawyer code, because if a complaint, if one would be levied against us, it would be for a judicial type of activity. It would be conduct on the bench. It would be conflict of interest. It wouldn't be a trust fund or missing a
statute of limitations. Talking about the Judicial Commission regulation. Okay.
Fit into judicial standards more appropriately.
Okay. I understand that. And is there anything else that are consequences of how you should be classified? What about instead of putting you under the Judicial Commission, which we don't have too much power over because it's set by statute and is an independent entity, that you would put under the OLR, which is lawyer discipline?
I'm sorry. Correct. I didn't understand.
Well, the Judicial Commission is set by statute.
Correct.
For us to increase their jurisdiction by adopting an SCR is not in the cards, I don't think. So if you're going to get disciplined by being a licensed member of the state bar, it would seem to me it would come under the OLR licensing for lawyers. And, you know, I haven't quite figured out how the code would then apply. Right. But there may be things that do.
Right, I understand.
That's an issue.
Right, okay. I understand. And as indicated, as a member of the Wisconsin Bar Association, we're, of course, required to follow whatever administrative regulations and procedure that the bar has. I mean, it's part of the privilege of being a lawyer, I guess, and burden and responsibilities of being a lawyer.
Counselor, I was very interested in your submissions, having been a judge on the Court of Appeals and now here, to learn that the Court of Appeals staff attorneys and our commissioners are permitted judicial membership status. And I noticed Pei Carlson is here, who is the chief staff attorney for the Court of Appeals, and perhaps that's why. How that's a fact I didn't know, I must confess. And given that I'm accepting that fact, are they then subject to the judicial code, in your view, rather than OLR for their conduct, or how does that work?
I'm not competent to answer that. I really don't completely understand what the staff attorneys do or how they come within that. I'm sure that the staff attorney would know that more so than I.
Okay, all right. I was just.
I'm sorry, but I just don't feel that I can even hazard a
And I'm assuming that the federal judges listed there are subject to federal judicial discipline.
The federal judges, of course, the federal district court judges, are their discipline is primarily through impeachment.
Right.
The impeachment
process. The circuit, the Court of Appeals has some jurisdiction.
Correct. And I noticed that Chief
Justice
Roberts, within the last several months, has promulgated some rules of conduct.
Exactly. And Justice Breyer has a report out to the court and to Congress relating that, and takes the position that the discipline system they now have, which is based in the circuit courts, is adequate, so that they are all subject to that. Oh, impeachment is possible too, but for less than impeachment.
Counsel, you make reference in your submission to other jurisdictions that have membership in the bar divided into both lawyers and judicial status, attorney and judicial status. And those include, apparently, you have on page 5, those among that do. You say, we propose, is consistent with the practice in numerous other jurisdictions, many apparently have no separate judicial status. But among those that do, some define judicial status in general terms that clearly would include us, and cite Rhode Island. Then you go on, but more importantly, there are other states that address the status of the United States administrative law judge particularly, and you cite California and D.C. and the state of Washington. The Chief took you through the kind of consequences, or some of the consequences, of being judicial status. Do you know how these other states approach it, other than saying, as you did in page 5, that they're is a separate judicial category for membership for dues. Do you know how they respond to the questions regarding continuing legal education, if any, or discipline, if any?
I'm not familiar with the CLE requirements of the. I know that various states, because we're dealing with, of course, 50 jurisdictions, and I know that some of these states do have CLU requirements, because at our annual conference, which I'm very involved in, people are very active in looking for the certificate of completion, which we prepare that they send to the state. So I know that there are from that affiliation. I know that there are various requirements for CLU training in the various states. As far as discipline is concerned, in fact, I've been involved in our association since about the mid-80s, and I've never seen a situation where an administrative law judge was disciplined by a bar association. We've been disciplined by the Merit Systems Protection Board, of course. That usually is severe enough that that takes care probably most of the problem. There was about a year ago, to answer your question, about a year ago, a complaint was filed against a judge, and I think it was in the state of Oregon. And the state of Oregon did, in fact, investigate the case. The judge said, well, you don't have jurisdiction over me because I'm an administrative law judge. The state of Oregon says, no, you're licensed in the state of Oregon. We do have jurisdiction over this license. They conducted an investigation, concluded that there was no merit to that particular claim, but the important, I guess, answer to the question is that they did conduct the investigation.
Was that the comparable entity to the OLR or the Judicial Commission?
I'm not so sure about that. I'm not so sure whether Oregon had a...
We can check that out.
But the Washington, D.C. bar is probably one of the most active as far as the judicial status. Greg Portratz is more familiar with that. He's going to speak later, and he has the actual provision section from the D.C. bar. But, of course, there are more administrative agencies in D.C., and so they're more familiar with this particular situation. So they probably have the most advanced and more functional.
The D.C. bar, a unified bar, so that everybody has to join it. That was my understanding.
I'm not so sure about that.
Okay, good.
I'm not
Thank
so sure
you. Do you have any other comments? Do you have any other questions? Because we have read your
okay.
petition, as
no.
is evident.
No, I have no other comments. Other than I was going to say, it's just a matter of reference that the chair of the Judicial Division for the American Bar Association last year was an administrative law judge. In fact, a Social Security administrative law judge from Oklahoma City, and so it that shows that the American Bar Association actually classes us in one group. Also, the new model rules of judicial conduct of the American Bar Association applies to administrative law judges.
Mm-hmm.
So in. With that in closing, I just say it's just based on our judicial function, which I think is the thing that we feel is most importantly to be looked at here. We believe that we are clearly judges of record, and we ask that our judicial status be continued by the State Bar of Wisconsin and that the administrative rules be amended to reflect that thing.
Our immigration judges, administrative law judges, do they have to be members of the bar? Do you know?
Immigration judges are not appointed under the Administrative Procedure Act. That's a separate category in the executive branch. They're immigration judges. That's their title. But as far as their requirement, as far as being licensed, or I'm not so sure.
The reason I ask is because there have been a series of newspaper articles raising questions about their independence from the political branch,
right,
and of which the immigration judges have complained bitterly, and that mean if that were true, and I don't know whether those allegations are or not, it would raise questions under the judicial code and I think under the lawyer's code of being a professional. Right. So
great, yeah. See, the Administrative Procedure Act that was passed in 1946, which administrative law judges are appointed under, not immigration judges, was passed for that particular reason to provide that judicial independence.
And that's true in the Wisconsin system, too.
Right.
So I recognize that. Question. Justice Bradley.
And that is, do you know if there are any immigration law judges in Wisconsin?
My recollection and my opinion, and I think I'm correct, that there are none.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you
very much.
I don't know if you have to leave, Mr. Schwartz, but I'd be willing to take you now out of order, if that's okay. All right. I know Mr. Basting is going to be here for the century. And Mr. Pocraft goes next. My question is, do administrative law judges in Wisconsin have to be members of the bar?
I guess the answer to that is mostly yes. I think that, to the best of my knowledge, anybody who is called an administrative law judge or hearing examiner in the agencies is a member of the Wisconsin bar, with the exception of there is a classification of a person at the Department of Transportation who do these driver license issues where there's high volume, I think, on whether you can maintain a license during dependency of a drunk driving or something. Those people, I believe, are not attorneys. That is the only thing that they do is at that specific area. This issue has come up a few times, I guess, over the years, and the way I have handled it is more as a manager rather than looking at this from the legal standards involved. The state has a classification called attorney, and that's set by the Department of Employment Relations. And that particular standard, in order for you to qualify to compete as a civil service position of attorney, you must be a member, active and up-to-date member of the state bar. And so whenever this issue has come up, whether somebody wants to be called a judge or whatever, I always go back to the fact that we hired every person in the office who's called a hearing examiner or ALJ as an attorney, and that requirement, that standard requires that you be an attorney.
Covers pay, too, I assume.
Excuse me?
Does it cover pay, too?
Yes.
Compensation.
Yes. And the other aspect of that, that at least in my agency that it gets involved is every year I have a yearly evaluation of every judge, and one of the standards that is in their job specifications is that they conform to the state bar rules on CLE, and so between those two things, we pretty much everybody in our office is an active member, and they're not. And years ago, I did look back at I think that the rules as they're defined for judges, and I thought that they were fairly clear that they were constitutional judges and they did not apply to administrative agency individuals.
And as to that covers. What you have said, it covers the other consequence of CLA, which I assume they required. So the third consequence is a discipline. I'm assuming you have annual evaluations. So you have a discipline, internal discipline system. Do you view your ALJs as subject to OLR?
Yes. So they're covered by both. The discipline that would be involved in the normal would be a normal state employee type of discipline. They have work rules that they're expected to conform to, and so that would be covered there. But in addition, obviously as a member of the bar, somebody can file a complaint with OLR, and that's been done.
And if there's a crime, that would be a problem for the. Yes. Discipline kind of issue.
Right. But I don't know. I mean, it just has not been a major issue with us. I guess just from a practical standpoint, the only point I would kind of raise is that the rules of discipline are really aimed at practicing lawyers, and they're not aimed at ALJs. And that does create a little bit of a problem because most of the rules, if you read them, are couched in terms of clients and various other behaviors, and that does make it somewhat difficult. Mm-hmm. But I think the state bar has been trying to address that in some of its newer rules, where they have are recognizing in much more detail government practice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Counsel, one of the points made by the earlier presenter was that the federal ALJs are prohibited from practicing law. What about the state ALJs? Can the ALJs practice law?
Yes, they can. As a matter of fact, and this might be another factor the court might want to consider, is that the ALJs in state service are covered, are unionized and covered by a contract of the State Attorneys Association. And one of the provisions of that contract is that as long as the attorney submits a request from his employer and can do it not during work hours, he can practice law. Not done very much, but it's there and certainly has been used in the past.
Mr. Schwartz, how do you get the designation of ALJ rather than hearing examiner or hearing officer? Does it depend on what agency you're assigned to?
I think that to some extent it's what agency you're assigned to. It also is actually in the statutes. If you look at a lot of the older statutes refer to hearing examiner, and some of the newer ones I've noticed have referred to ALJ. In our case, we have rules of practice, and one of the rules is that they can be referred to as administrative law judge. So it's an interchangeable term. I think that the newer term is being used in the Model Acts, and I was just yesterday looking at a new model act, Administrative Procedure Act for the country, and it makes that designation of administrative law judge.
Good. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. And I was going to apologize for imposing on you, but once you appear here, you're subject to the law. It's part of the jurisdiction. So, thank but you. Thank you very thank much. I'll move to the other appearances. I have Thomas Basting and Gregory Pokras. If anyone else would like to appear, please let us know. Mr. Basting.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Tom Basting. I'm here this morning appearing on behalf of the State Bar of Wisconsin Board of Governors as President-elect of the State Bar. The Chief Justice has already extracted two concessions.
That was not my design, so tell me what I did.
Which I will not go into, although I addressed those issues in the memo that I submitted to the court. But let me begin by taking a crack at defining what I see as the, using the old overused cliche of the view from 30,000 feet, at the issue that is before the court today. And as I see the issue, and as the Board of Governors sees the issue, it can be stated as in this way: should licensed Wisconsin lawyers who happen to perform judicial functions for the executive branch of the federal government, and I might add, in view of Mr. Schwartz's invited comments, and the state government, be entitled to special judicial status under Supreme Court Rule 10.3. That is the issue. That was the issue raised by this petition, and this petition came as a result of a letter that was sent out by the executive director of the bar, Mr. Brown, when it was discovered that the federal administrative law judges had in a sense fallen through the cracks of the bar's stated administration of dues in the state of Wisconsin, and it came to the bar's attention that they did not come under Rule 10.3, although they had for many, many years been reporting their status to the bar as exempt under 10.3 and were not subject to any CLE requirements in the state and were not subject to any judicial continuing education requirements, although, as they indicate, they do take these requirements from the federal government, but they have never petitioned the Board of Bar Examiners to have those particular seminars that they take okayed by the Board of Bar Examiners for inclusion in the CLE requirements and have never asked for judicial exemptions under that status. And it appeared to the Board of Governors in the arguments that took place, and this, by the way, was an overwhelming vote, a majority of the board. There were two dissensions. One of the dissenters has filed objection to the board's position and agrees with the position set forth in the petition. But in looking at 10.3, it was fairly obvious when looking at the exemptions that this court, in creating that rule, said we are going to offer special judicial status to judges state and federal, when you look at the magistrates and the U.S. bankruptcy judges, who are part of the separate judicial branch of the government, not part of the executive branch of government. And that appears to be what the intent of this court was when it created Rule 10.3. So the board, in looking at that, said We do not believe that judges or that lawyers performing judicial functions, and there are only five of them that we're talking about here for the executive branch, should have this special judicial status, and therefore the board has opposed this petition.
Mr. Basting, if I could, I understand the position of the Board of Governors in this area, and I guess I have some questions about whether or not a person performing a judicial function for an executive branch should come under 10.3. And quite frankly, I hadn't thought about this until the petition came in, and I think the Chief is correct. It may relate to state ALJs as well. But there does appear to be somewhat of a hole within the rules with respect to someone who performs this function. Now, they may not be technically a judicial officer under the Constitution. I'm not sure they should come under 10.3, as the petition suggests. But I do question whether, given the nature of discipline or given the nature of problems that may occur, because they are performing a slightly different function than somebody who's going out and obtaining clients and doing representation, should we have a rule that governs administrative legal officials, whether it be in the federal or state area? Should we be looking at creating a rule that deals specifically with the individuals that are subject to this petition and that may be indirectly impacted by this petition from the state?
Excellent question, but and not a question.
And you may not have dealt with that with the Board of Governors.
Not a question that was dealt with by the Board of Governors. So what I'm going to, the way I'm going to respond to that question is coming out of this brain and not out of anything that was discussed by the Board of Governors. I would say in response to that, from my standpoint, from the standpoint of a practicing lawyer, from a standpoint of looking at the rule and to me, keeping sacred the separation of powers and having this court deal with those folks and those people who are involved with the judicial branch, and letting the legislature and letting Congress deal with those folks who work for the executive branch of government, I don't think that creating a separate rule to carve out federal administrative law judges, immigration judges, state administrative law judges, state hearing examiners, I don't know where it ends. And this court doesn't really have control as to how those people, and I shouldn't refer to them as those people, how administrative law judges function. The legislature can change that at any time. The legislature could say, you don't have to be a lawyer to be an administrative law judge. The legislature can say any of those things that they want to, because they control that. And so from my standpoint, holding sacred the separation of powers, I don't think we should be carving out exceptions for people who want to say, we act like judges, we perform like judges, but we are not part of the judiciary. We are really part of the executive branch. I don't think we should be carving out those exceptions.
Any other questions?
Mr. Basting, is it correct that the staff attorneys for the Court of Appeals are treated as judges under 10.03?
I don't know the answer to that. I thought they were seeking to be treated as judges.
Your commissioners are.
Right.
This court's court commissioners. I don't think the Court of Appeals are, but I'm not sure, Justice Crutchfield.
But at this point, it's your understanding, based on what Mr. Brown just indicated, that they're asking to be within the judicial classification.
I don't think there's a petition before this court at the present time, but there's something in the wind, I've heard.
All right, thank
you. Oh, I see. Okay. Because the materials we got said they were.
Okay.
That were provided to us for this petition, which is why I asked the question, because I was surprised. I didn't realize that, but it was stated as a fact. So, well,
The rule says judges of courts of records, full-time family court commissioners, full-time court commissioners, U.S. bankruptcy judges, etc. And that is where we are.
Yes.
Under this. But I'm going to, Ms. Carlson, since you're here, I will call on you. Anything else from Mr. Baister? Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Before I call on Greg Pokratz, I'm going to call on Ms. Carlson, who's a staff attorney with the Court of Appeals. Carlson.
Do you want to start with questions, or should I?
Sure.
What
do you do?
Well, let me explain why I'm here. I'm here, obviously, as Justice Wogensek, as you probably all realize, as a very interested observer and monitor, and in part because in July of 2005, myself and members of my staff received a letter, which I believe is somewhat similar to what the current petitioners received from the executive director of the State Bar, suggesting that the State Bar was going to change our classification. And just to clarify, under current staff attorneys, like your commissioners, are classified as non-voting judicial statuses for State Bar purposes. I have documentation going back to 1979 and 1980, exchanges between then Steve Smay from the State Bar and Chief Justice Bialfus establishing that status, and which I think I provided to Attorney Rich, but I certainly can.
Well, that's probably why it was in the materials, because it was Julie Rich, our commissioner's materials, that pointed that out. It's something that I really didn't realize, and if you read the rule, you're not listed in the rule.
Granted, I don't think anyone would suggest that we're one of the nouns that are in that rule.
You do judicial education through David Haas's office.
Yes. We're all.
As I remember, since I sit on that committee, and I've seen you, so you do that. And you, what fees do you pay to the bar now?
We pay the non-voting judicial status, which is a reduced rate, not the full load that you were. We don't get assessed for a couple of the fees. I frankly don't recall what they are. I know that whatever the fee that goes to fund OLR, I think we don't get assessed against.
I don't know that you get assessed with any of the OLR or BBE or the security fund, if I understand it. Unlike the Supreme Court justices, who, if they impose an assessment, they pay it too. That's been sort of the rule that the court has followed. Okay. So as to fees, you don't pay full fare. As to CLAE, you comply with the judicial education, because we've gone through your applications, right, et cetera. You're not required necessarily, I don't think, but maybe I'm wrong, to do the 5-credit in-state mandatory.
As I understand, and I haven't talked with David Haas about this, but as I understand it and what I tell the attorneys in the office, but is that we're required to do the 60 credits over the 6-year cycle. We do have to do the 5-state in-state minimum.
Okay.
We're not permitted to go to the college, to the judicial college. And
that's why I raised a question about the 5 points. And you don't necessarily attend the judicial conference.
Correct.
So, which is where many of us pick up our 5 points. Okay. Got it.
Okay. Is there anything?
Now, the third issue is discipline. We haven't had that issue.
And I hope we never do. I tell, frankly, we're currently in the hiring process for a new attorney, and I told all of the candidates during the interview process that there are certain parts of SCR 60 that apply to, that I believe, and I think the court, the judges believe, apply to staff attorneys because we are closer, we are within the decision-making process. We are also required to file the financial disclosure form with the state ethics board that we are provided every year. We cannot practice law over some of the other things that.
Are the conflict of interest provisions of the judicial code applicable to the staff attorneys at the Court of Appeals?
That's an area in the news these days. Well, I would, since we are required to fill out the form, one would think that the reason for filling out that financial disclosure form is in part to provide the background information for that. I do know that there was a time when one of my predecessors was performing one of his normal functions, which is the jurisdiction check, and the case involved his brother, and he assigned that particular function to myself.
I think something that occurs to me more, and probably because it's been in the news, is stockholding of staff attorneys. Now, you can't check on whether they're operating contrary to their position in stocks because the opinions are not authored. The PC, say a PC of the court, so you don't know which staff attorney. So there's really no way someone outside the system can police whether they have a conflict of interest or they don't have a conflict of interest.
Well, I agree that someone outside the system wouldn't necessarily be able to find that information easily, but certainly within the system, I think we all fill out the form and we know what the reasons for that are. And if an attorney had a significant, however that's defined, I don't want to go there.
Sure. I can understand that.
Financial stake in a publicly held company, if they can't, they should come to me and say, I can't work on this case. We've had attorneys in the office who have asked, and that request has been honored, to not work on sexual predator cases because their husband was employed by DOC as an examiner. So I think there are internal.
But they are not really subject to public review, as a judge would be, where you can see that judge worked on a particular matter.
Someone would have to work through the court system to identify who worked on a particular case, but, I mean, that certainly can be determined in the case management system.
Now, the Code of Judicial Conduct defines judge to be justice of this court, judge of the Court of Appeals, judge of the Circuit Court, reserve judge, municipal judge, court commissioner, and anyone, whether or not a lawyer, who is an officer, whether or not a lawyer, who is an officer of the judicial system and who performs judicial functions. You think you come under the latter?
I think that's the position that the court has taken historically over the it's broad enough to bring staff attorneys within the...
Okay.
Now, who is the disciplinary body is the thing that, frankly, I don't know, because I looked at I just looked at it, and we are not a judge, we are not a circuit or a supplemental court commissioner.
So I think under 75781, you cannot be subject to the judicial commission, because that's statutory. Yeah,
right.
That employs the judges that are established under our Wisconsin Constitution, Article 7, in addition to circuit court and supplemental court commissioners and Supreme Court.
Right, and frankly, whenever this discussion has come up among the judges, the ultimate disciplinary authority is employment status and loss thereof.
But that's employment status, which means you might lose your job as staff attorney, but still have a license to practice law, which is what the issue is with the administrative law judges.
And if OLR were to choose to pursue something that would arise out of that situation, I would imagine that it's within their authority. I don't think anyone's disputing that we're...
That you're lawyers.
That we're lawyers, that's correct.
All right. Do you want to add anything to this, Ms. Carroll?
Just that, and I have mentioned this with Attorney Rich, that since this whole topic is in front of the court, and at least a couple of years ago, the State Bar had staff attorneys on their radar screen as someone that was also perhaps inappropriately classed. I know the Court of Appeals would support clarifying 10.03 to... If the court feels there's a need to specifically indicate that staff attorneys for the Court of Appeals would fall into the judicial class, that they would support that in keeping with the practice since 1979, 1980.
What about falling into the class of lawyers? Pay full freight.
Well, I suspect the judges don't care about that.
The state. We do care.
But no, I'm talking about, I don't think the Court of Appeals judges care about what fees are assessed against the.
But what do you care about? You don't care? Fees, CLE, or discipline? I mean, those seem to be the three consequences.
Well, the CLE, where we're subject to, we're within the judicial education system. The fees, as I understand the early correspondence between Chief Justice Balfus and the bar at that time, the rationale for classifying staff attorneys within the judicial category was in part because of the fees should not be held to apply to staff attorneys because they fund the boards that we're not subject to.
Ms. Carlson, was part of the rationale at the time the function of staff attorneys as far as working on and authoring per curiam opinions for the Court of Appeals?
The documents speak to themselves. I'm not sure that at that time that authoring per curiam opinions was at the forefront of the discussion at that time, because at least as I understand it, I've been with the court since 82, so this even predated my employment, but I was a clerk at that time, and frankly at that time staff attorneys did not write that many opinions for the court. They were more a motion facilitator, and the function of per curiam drafting has really evolved over the years.
But that is a function.
That certainly is.
Are staff attorneys required to be licensed attorneys in the state of Wisconsin?
We are required to be licensed attorneys. I know of one instance where we had an attorney who was licensed in the state of Minnesota and worked for us while she went through the reciprocal to get her license shifted over to Minnesota, and that is Attorney Rich, so she can speak to that process. But she was licensed in Minnesota at the time.
But your requirement was licensing. It was a matter of
it was in the process.
Time period.
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
Are your law clerks required to be licensed in the state?
I believe they're not. In fact, I know they're not. I don't know where that comes from, but I know that judges routinely will hire out-of-state graduates who may be sitting for the bar, but there's no requirement. I think much like your clerks, as I understand it.
All right.
Anything else?
Anything you want to add to this, Ms. Carlson?
Just interested observing.
Well, we're interested in hearing you, too. Thank you. I would like to complete the hearing, and so we have one left, as far as I can tell. So, Mr. Pokras, you can tell us about the court commissioners for this court. We're delighted to see you again.
Well, I have to say it's a little awkward for me to be here. Strange to be here in this situation. I would say that all three of us, actually all five of us, this isn't a fight we asked for. Things were sailing along pretty well for 26 years, for one of us anyway, back to 1981 as a judicial member. So this whole thing was sort of dumped on us in fall. And it's not a fight we chose, and we just simply have to be here. What I would like to do is to I want to respond to Mr. Basting, and I also want to fill in some of the questions that were raised when Judge Bernoski spoke, and hopefully give you a little bit better idea of just what the situation is here. But at the outset, what I would ask the court to do, now, I very well know that there are other groups that are in sort of a gray status. I had talked to Peg last fall about the staff attorneys, and certainly I know about uncertainty, if there is any, with the state hearing examiners or ALJs, although apparently they're not asking for judicial status. But bottom line is we would ask the court to evaluate the five of us based on what we've presented and evaluate our own qualifications and our own background, and not simply, for example, tie us in with some state administrative people simply because we may or may not share the same title. In all honesty, I know you asked Judge Bernoski about state ALJs. The truth is we don't know how they're picked, how they're trained, paid, disciplined, what their duties are. I mean, frankly, we know almost nothing about them. And if they want the same status that we do, we really think they should come to the court and present their own case on their own merits. So I'd ask you to look at it really from, you know, isolate on us because it is indeed our position, our petition. And then before I get into a few more things, I do think the court should be familiar with Section 3105 of Title V of the U.S. Code. That is indeed the statute under which we exist. And it's very short, so if I could, I'll just read it. It says, each agency shall appoint as many administrative law judges as are necessary for proceedings required to be conducted in accordance with Sections 556 and 557 of this title. And by the way, that refers to the Administrative Procedure Act in 1946. Administrative law judges shall be assigned to cases in rotation so far as practicable and may not perform duties inconsistent with their duties and responsibilities as administrative law judges. So we exist, I mean, by title and by, you know, specific designation, we exist under the U.S. Code. Okay. Now, Mr. Basting seems to be somewhat enamored with the distinction between the executive branch and the judicial branch. I think he used the word sacred. We are indeed guilty, if that's the right term, we're guilty of being executive branch judges. But it might be a surprise to him to know that the United States Tax Court, the U.S. Court of Military Appeals, the U.S. Court of Veterans Appeals, the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, and every military court-martial trial judge, and by the way, those are people that can sentence people to death, all of those people are executive branch judges. So while there's a distinction, I really think it's a distinction without a practical difference. And I think it's highlighted by the treatment, to begin with, by the D.C. bar of how they look at their judicial status. And I picked the D.C. bar because, quite obviously, that's the jurisdiction. And it is an integrated bar, by the way. It's the jurisdiction with the most familiarity with the whole administrative judiciary. And the District of Columbia Bar, and I'll read this to you, this is also short. They classify as judicial members, judges of courts of record, full-time court commissioners, U.S. bankruptcy judges, U.S. magistrate judges, and all other persons who perform a judicial function on an exclusive basis in an official capacity created by federal statute or administrative agency rule and are not engaged in the practice of law. So, of course, were we in D.C., there wouldn't be any question about it. And then secondly, the American Bar Association.
Mr. Go ahead. Hillcrest, thank you. Because you ended with, and are not engaged in the practice of law.
That's correct.
And that caused my ears perk up and to sit up. You start out your comments by saying, look at us, we're the five that filed the petition. My response is, I know, but, you know, what we do has implications or could have implications for greater than you. So I can understand from your point of view, look at us. You're the ones that took the trouble and time to put all this together. But from my point of view, it's broader than that. One difference, perhaps a significant difference, but certainly a difference, is that you cannot practice law. That's the phrase I just did. Are there any other differences that you can assert that would suggest that if another entity tomorrow files a petition, that, you know, that are unique to you, you know, that we don't have a ripple effect. Maybe we should have a ripple effect, you know, but I'm just In other words, the next group and the next group and the next group. But that's one distinction. You can't practice law. Anything else that would cause you to be isolated, the kind of isolation that you seek?
I think that certainly the not practicing law is important. I think, secondly, I agree that there should be a mechanism for disciplining us, as there is for disciplining a regular practicing attorney or a Supreme Court commissioner or you, for example. There has to be a mechanism for it. And in our particular case, and I'm not going to comment on the state people. I didn't quite understand with Mr. Schwartz how exactly they could be disciplined. In our case, there really isn't that much of a mystery about it. If I do something in the course of my judicial duties, you know, to a litigant, you know, act improperly, a complaint can be filed with me. There's a mechanism for doing it. There's a complaint form, just as there is for a circuit court judge. And it's filed with the regional chief judge of my agency. It then goes up the line, and the agency can then prosecute me. They act as it's actually a litigated adversarial situation. They can prosecute me in front of the U.S. Merit Systems Protection Board and seek my removal. Okay, and that's the same thing that the Judicial Commission would do and then prosecute it in front of this court. Now, if that happens to me sometime, and I lose my lifetime appointment, I am no longer a federal ALJ, I obviously should not have, I'm not a judge anymore. So if this court says I have judicial status here normally, I lose it. I am now, I believe, at that point subject to OLR. If OLR wants to come after me and say, okay, what this judge did, that it was so egregious that it should also warrant the removal or suspension, whatever, of his license, yes, I believe I'm totally subject to that.
Are you advancing that you should be disciplined under the jurisdiction of the Judicial Commission, or that there should be no state entity that can address discipline for you?
I would say there should not be, in the first instance. I think it's a two-tiered disciplinary system. I think on the first tier, no. I don't believe the state should come after us. I wouldn't personally have a problem with it, but if Jim Alexander prosecutes me under the judicial commission,
He doesn't have the authority.
No, but if I were, it'd be a problem because I'm appointed by a federal agency.
Well, that's not. He can't do it under the Judicial Commission. So that's why I ask you, because if you're going to say that, I'd say you don't have authority. Okay. So then you're asking that there be no discipline. You want to be a judge, but you don't want anyone to discipline you in the state.
No, I do. The U.S. Merit Systems Protection Board. I don't have all those statutes. I can't give it to you, but they have.
How do we lift your license?
Excuse me?
You need a license. How do we lift your license in the state?
Since all I do now are judicial functioning activities, if the Merit Systems Board either suspends me or removes me, I believe that you could then, via the OLR, come after my license, because I'm no longer a judge.
Here's the problem. 22.001, which is the procedures for the lawyer regulation system, says attorney means a person admitted to practice of law that you fit, or in another jurisdiction who appears here. In the state, who appears before a court or within the state, or engages in any other activity in the state that constitutes the practice of law. So the problem, from when I read that, and I'm reading it, having seen it a million times, but as I read it now, raises the question whether an attorney who is admitted to the practice of law and is not engaged in the practice of law, but engaged as an ALJ, fits within the OLR definition. And that goes for a state ALJ who can't practice law, and it goes for Peg Carlson who can't practice.
State ALJs can't.
Some can, some can't.
Let me address that by posing another situation. 20 or 25 years ago, there was a circuit judge, I think up near Appleton, who, if I'm not mistaken, was convicted of tax evasion, and I believe you then removed him. Okay. What happened to his license after that? Now, I don't know the answer to that, and actually I tried to look. But I would assume that once you removed him from his judicial duties, you could still, if the tax evasion was enough to pull his license, you could then get him through the normal attorney system. And the ICR's the same way.
That's an issue that may come up. That is an issue that may come to the court. Anyway, it seems as if there might be some little holes in here. But your position is that you would be subject to OLR discipline. That's your
position. Ultimately, yeah, my license, you can, whether I'm a judicial status person or not, ultimately, OLR and you can get my license. It's just that in the first instance, it's pointless to go to OLR. If I wrong a litigant, as a judge would, you know, through improper behavior, how is OLR possibly going to address that?
Both as an attorney. The disciplined under the provisions of the oath as an attorney, you know.
Except I'm functioning as a judge, and there's a whole separate federal mechanism for it. And it's why duplicate what the feds are doing to me and are set up to do? I mean, that's why they exist. That's why the Merit Systems Protection Board exists, to do this. And they have done it. I did cite some cases along that line. Another thing I wanted to point out, in addition to the D.C. bar, and just let me say that I looked at all 51 of the states in the D.C. Jurisdiction, obviously, and they're all over, okay? Some of the bars are integrated, some aren't. Some have judicial status, some don't. Some lump judges and all government attorneys together, and some don't. It was very, very hard to draw firm conclusions about how the states go. They went all over. And my focus tended to be particularly on D.C. because they're the people that have the most experience with us. And I also had some focus, obviously, on the ABA Model Code of Judicial Conduct, which we are subject to. The Merit Systems Board has said that we are. And that code applies to anyone who is authorized to perform judicial functions, including a member of the administrative law judiciary. And then the comment to that, I won't read it, but it does three or four times mention judicial function. And that's what we're trying to stress to you. D.C. looks at the judicial function. The ABA Model Code looks at judicial function. They don't look at whether we're in the executive branch or the judiciary. To me, I give full deference to the separation of powers, but the reality is we have a particularly complex legal system here. Feds are particularly complex, and this court right now is sitting as a legislature. It's a court, but it's sitting as a rulemaking body. And to just kind of arbitrarily and somewhat provincially say, well, you're part of that branch of government, therefore you are not a judge, quite frankly, I think is silly. I think that's really about it. One last thing is that the whole question about our education, judicial education, we are subject to fairly strict requirements. We have no problem reporting them. But I think that the whole question of our education is a little bit of a red herring here, because if we don't get put under judicial status and we're active lawyers, at that point, I have to wonder whether we would then come under SCR 3104 sub 2. And that says a lawyer who does not engage in the practice of law in Wisconsin at any time during the reporting period is exempt from CLE requirements. So my position would be, reading this, is if I do have regular status, I'm still not practicing law, and I'm still not going to do the CLE. But the reality is, if I have judicial status, of course, I'm subject to what the agency makes me do. So I'm not certain that a whole lot of focus ought to be put on the judicial education. It may be more simply a matter of us reporting it, and we'll be very happy. We have a person who, one of her duties in our office is to keep track of our time. We'd be very happy to report it. That's really all I have at this point, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pokrest. It's good seeing you again, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Process.
There are 14 administrative law judges
in Wisconsin, based in Wisconsin.
And there are five of you who are petitioning.
Correct.
All right. The other nine paying any dues to the state?
The other nine are all members of bars in other states, because our agency requires us to be a bar member in good standing in whatever
some
classification.
Bar. Of some bar.
So as a result, we have Illinois and Indiana, and there may be a few others there. It's the only way the agency can operate, because with all the different offices, if people had to be licensed in the state in which they sit, it would be very, very difficult. As far as I know, this affects only the five of us at this present time. It's impossible for us to know. For example, the National Labor Relations Board has 50 ALJs across the country. My assumption is that none of those are Wisconsin attorneys and had judicial status up until last fall. Otherwise, I think that the state bar would have sent the same letter to them, and we'd know about them at this point. So as best we – frankly, the state bar has got a better idea of us, who's out there. We assume we're the only five in the whole federal judiciary, administrative judiciary, who are affected by this.
Thank you. Did you have a question? Sorry.
I was just going to ask Judge Pokrest if on occasion he misses us.
Don't ask a question unless you know the answer.
Right to remain silent.
We miss you, so I would assume that.
Is this a court of record?
It's been debated too, you know, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just ask Mr. Basting. Would an administrative law judge, if classified as a lawyer, fall out from CLE because they don't practice law in the state?
I haven't thought about that question. I think they would still have to report, but I don't know the answer to that question.
Good. All right. Thank you. No one else appearing for 60609, the matter of petition of the United States Administrative Law Judges appointed under 5 U.S.C. Section 3105 to amend SCR 10.033A. The hearing on that petition is closed. The court will recess for lunch, and we hope you all take lunch too. And when you get back, we'll start with yet again the trust account. But what we're going to do is, when we come back, we will not be in a rules hearing. We are going to be in an administrative open conference, because we've already had hearings on the trust account. And so the first thing the court will handle, which should be very, very quick, is request for funding of the court improvement program. And then we'll take trust. Then we'll start back on the rest of the agenda in open hearing. With that, we're in recess. How long does everybody want? 1:30. 1:30, says the court. We'll be back at 1:30.